This is 16.9, the podcast. I'm Dave Haynes. I write about the digital signage business on my blog, 16.9. I celebrate great and intriguing work. I explore and I explain new technology, and I filter the industry BS. This podcast gives listeners a chance to get beyond the press releases and trade show chatter and hear from some of the most successful, influential, and interesting people in this business. In this episode, I'm speaking with Neil Willis, the CEO and founder of Hypersign, a digital signage software company located in Greenville, South Carolina. Neil talks about a long career path that had very humble beginnings. He was working in the Air Force, and he was sweeping floors part-time at a big box store just to pay the family bills. He had a chance encounter at that big box that got him into IT and later into systems integration. Years later, he's running a very successful company, heavily focused on working in K-12 schools and in healthcare.
So Neil, maybe a lot of people aren't all that familiar with Hypersign. So could you give me a background on the company, how you got started and, you know, size of it, usual stuff you would tell somebody about your company first time they ran into you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it probably goes back, and I had an integration company that I started back in 2002 called Synergy Systems. And Synergy was a large AVIT integrator. We're one of the largest in the Southeast, actually, about 100 some employees. That really focused on capital and capital-funded projects for universities and K-12 schools. And we grew that office to, actually, we had four locations ranging anywhere from around Charlotte all the way down to Orlando, and grew that business really, really, you know, it, from an integration standpoint, it's fairly large. It was right near $20 million in revenue and doing really well. And part of that, one of the projects we did out of Charleston was just in the onset of digital signage, and we had actually installed a solution that is fairly well known in the industry. It was very expensive and very difficult to learn. And the project for us that year was around $5 million. That included all the AVIT, cabling infrastructure, CCTV, everything else was included in it. So several weeks in front of the Christmas vacation, I went into the food court, which had five large 55-inch displays running this signage solution. And they had not been updated in weeks. So I went to the cafeteria manager and I asked her, I said, what's the deal? What's going on? And she says, it's just too hard. And she goes, I had to go through this 4-day training course on how to be able to create and do content for this system. And she goes, I have to have this dongle plug on the back of my Windows machine to be able to edit the content. So I'm out for a meeting or out for the day for being sick. My system manager she has to use my computer in order to be able to do it. She can't do it on her computer. And it costs so much money. It costs $1,500 just to be able to get a designer part of this application on her computer that we can't afford that. And she goes, I make food for kids. And I'm like, all right, that's pretty simply said. And so we'd already done about 12 schools out of the school district. You know, that particular year, we did about $7.5 million with this particular customer. So there was no way I was going to let this kind of fall through my fingers. So I sat down with her and I said, okay. And we were doing IPTV solutions. We had actually designed some. They were being implemented all over the schools, competing with like VBrick and those things and doing really well with it. And so digital signage was something we knew about. We just didn't have a solution. We were reselling a solution. So I sat down with her and I said, if you were to have your own solution, what would it do? What would you want it to do? And she said, well, let's do something that everybody knows in the education industry. I said, what is that? She said, PowerPoint. I'm like, oh, great. We're going to put PowerPoint on a PC and we're going to scan convert it because that was prior to the HDMI days. We're going to, you know, put it up on a PC. She said, no. I want PowerPoint over here. And, you know, she kind of motioned her hand over, but over maybe to this side of it, I want live television. And then maybe below it, we can actually put like those little news feeds things you know they have that comes up. And I said, the RSS news feed. She goes, yeah. I said, okay, maybe we got something here. I said, let me go back to my dev team that does my IPTV and let's see what we can come up with. And this was in December. This was just before the Christmas holidays in 2009. So we built the solution. Actually, I'm sorry, 2008. So we built the solution, started building a prototype for it. And that next summer, we actually delivered it to the school district. Said, we'd like for you to replace the system we sold you last year with our stuff. And we're going to give it to you for no cost. We just want you to kick the tires. We want you just to beat the hell out of it. We want you just to really, you know, enjoy it and tell us what you think. Because we don't know if we've done a good job with this or not. We want to know firsthand if we've done a good job. So they did it and they loved it. They absolutely loved it. And they said, matter of fact, we want it in every school, all 45 schools in the district. We want it. And then pretty much another school district called us and said, we want it too. At that point, it was an enterprise solution. It wasn't a cloud solution. It was running off of a server. So we began to grow it. We decided, I made friends with a guy named Chris Gibbs. He's about 2 hours away from me. And me and Chris met up, and he'd heard about Hypersign, all the success we were starting to have in the education market. So he calls me up and he says, "Neil, I'd like to meet you." I said, "Sure." So we met together, became buddies. And he said, "I heard you know a lot about IP television, stuff like that." And I said, "Yes, I do." He said, "I'm wanting to be able to put live stuff for my conference up on, like if you have a seminar that's recorded, I want to be able to put it up on the web afterwards, kind of like you're doing a YouTube, but a private YouTube." I said, "Yeah, we can do that." And he said, "Cool." So we worked out an agreement. And he said, "I have a conference called Digital Signage Expo." And I said, "Well, that's kind of funny. We just actually created a digital signage title that we're calling Hypersign. We did it, last year, rolled out last summer." He said, "Well, my conference is in February." He said, "I'd love for you to be a part of it." And I said, "Sure." So we actually did a booth that next year. And then we were actually doing the video and stuff for Vista. And we won Best of DSE in 2010 for our alert feature. Because one thing that we did, in addition to the PowerPoint, is we made sure that in a school environment, you can trigger an alert which changed the content of the displays immediately. Mm-hmm. There was no delay. And nobody was doing that. Nobody in any industry in digital signage was doing that alert functionality. I mean, we can trigger right now from a soft trigger, from a feed, or from a hard contact closure, and we've done it the same way since 2010. And currently, to my knowledge, we're also the only ones that actually does full support for PowerPoint, meaning that we maintain all the animations and transitions. Even right now, they're chopping up into JPEGs and creating slideshows. So those are the two bits of really unique, I guess, components of the architecture that made it work. So then we began to grow, and we won DSC again in Lexico a couple of years. In 2013, we won Best of Infocom, won Best of HIMSS last year at the Healthcare IT Conference, and began just to grow the solution, focusing on education and healthcare.
So at some point, your business kind of transformed from being an integrator to being Hypersign, or did you just kind of spin it off into its own company?
I spun it off into its own company, and I sold the integration company in 2013.
Okay.
To a private company that really wanted to be in that space and did not have a presence in South Carolina, which really we were, even though we branched all the way down to Florida, the lion's share of the business was South Carolina and Georgia. So they wanted to have a presence there, and I was all too ready to be able to use that to help fund my company. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I did. Okay. And so we began to grow, and in the time frame, we began to really develop relationships with industry partners. That's really what helped us grow to the next level was those relationships.
Okay. So just to back up a fair amount, you came out of the Air Force, right? You were engineer in the Air Force and then started ISP?
Yeah, I was actually in Air Force Academy, and I graduated with my double E, double major and the double E in computer science. And then I served after that. And then while I was stationed at Little Rock Air Force Base, I was when I went through my training inside the Air Force Academy, I was actually trained to be an intelligence engineer and officer. So I was stationed at Little Rock because Bill Clinton had gone in office as a president. Mm-hmm. And he had determined that Little Rock Air Force Base was going to be his base station, not Langley, which is the first president's ever done that. So he changed Air Force One's base station to being Little Rock Air Force Base, which means they had to have direct support for Air Force One. And the only people that are allowed to be able to do anything on Air Force One or associate with Air Force One or anything that had to be involved in and go through intelligence training. So I actually called Little Rock, Arkansas, my home for 7.5 years, and haven't been back there since then, but anyway. But in the time frame I was there, and when I was actually full-time active duty, you don't make a lot of money in service, unfortunately. You really don't. And here I was. I was a young father, young husband and father, and had to be able to try to make ends meet. So I would take if you're anywhere in Arkansas, there is a buttload of Walmarts and Sam's. They're everywhere, mm-hmm. So on the weekends, I went to Sam's Club, and I started sweeping floors.
Wow.
And so I'm sitting, and that was a humbling experience for me, to be in my mid-20s, to have, a very technical degree from the United States Air Force Academy, and to be able to be sweeping floors in a warehouse. Hmm. But, you do what you got to do to be able to support your family. My parents were, I was brought up with humble beginnings. My dad was a welder, my mom a school teacher, so not afraid of working hard. So I got to the point to where I was sweeping floors, and I was actually around the computer section sweeping the floor, and I was in front of the Dell computer section. As a matter of fact, I remember that. And a lady walks up to me, older lady, she's probably in her mid-60s, early mid-60s. And she says, "Excuse me, son." She goes, "Do you know anything about these things?" And I said, what, computer monitors? And these are CRTs, if that tells you anything. Mm-hmm. These are way before the flat panel days. And so I said, yeah, do you want the layman's version or the technical version? And she goes, give me the technical version. I said, well, the CRT stands for cathode ray tube, but I said, it's actually a tube of electrons that fires forward a phosphorus screen, you know, illuminating on horizontal and vertical deflection plates to be able to generate an image in 1-3 colors or a mixture of those three. And I started, you know, how much power, you know, how much, you know, negative volts DC it was generating from the CRT. And she stops me. She says, okay, that's fine. That's good enough. And I said, okay. And I told her, I said, hey, if you decide to buy a computer, let me know and I'll come install it for you at your house. And I know it sounds kind of weird these days, but back in the 90s when that was happening, it still was fairly safe because these elderly people would come in and buy computers and not know what to do with them. So they'd pay me $25.
Sure.
And I'd go to their house and I'd go install it. So about a month and a half goes by later and this lady calls me up in my lab at the on the base. And she goes, can I speak to Neil Willis? And they gave me the phone, and she says, you know, this is Diana. She goes, I talked to you the other day at Sam's Club. And I said, yes, ma'am. I said, absolutely. And she goes, well, what I didn't tell you is I'm the executive vice president of Delta Dental. I said, okay. And she goes, and I'd like to talk to you about becoming our IT director for the United States. I said, I'm 25 years old. So me and my wife at the time, my first wife, and my little boy, he was 6 months old, go to Outback Steakhouse with her and the CEO of the company. And we're sitting there making a deal saying I had 6 weeks left on that before I had to be a chance to renew on my commitment to the Air Force. Mm-hmm. And they said, okay, if they offer you $35,000, then we're going to go. And this was in 1995. And I said, we're going to go. So they offered me 70. 25 years old. And I know that sound to all these like .com guys right now, $70,000 is pocket change. But in 1995 at 25 years old, dang, that was not bad, you know? Yeah. So I worked for a few years for them. I built a national claims clearinghouse that allowed them to be able to digitally scan dental x-rays and submit them. And this is before really a commercial internet was available. I was using, Wildcat by Mustang software, a BBS. So I modified a BBS to be able to make an electronic claims clearinghouse that would take these claims and the associated x-rays and distribute them to the appropriate insurance company, not just Delta Dental, but Blue Cross and whoever it might be. Mm-hmm. So basically became an internet type thing, you know, a multi-point distributed network that was operating off a huge bank mm-hmm. of U.S. robotics modems on a baker's rack.
Yeah.
And so with that, like anybody else, I started designing web pages, you know, because AOL has started to take about, they're going to talk to the internet, them and CompuServe, and I started designing for my church and then decided I wanted to open up an ISP because I had inadvertently run across a piece of pornography without even looking for it. I was looking for a Java programmer. And I said, you know, if I've got this problem, other people will as well. So I looked around and they told me, they said, you can't have an internet company that blocks access to content because that's censorship. I literally got that from everybody. And I said, that's bull. I said, you know, a parent can actually, you know, control what they want their children to be able to see. That's not censorship. That's parenting, you know. So I actually got some of my members of my church and I raised $115,000 to start my ISP. And then I resigned my position as IT director of Delta Dental to be able to go full time with my ISP. Huh. And so that went really well. So, but yeah, that was the ISP portion of my step ladder. You know, that's where I am.
So then you've also, just looking at your background, your LinkedIn profile, you've spent a lot of time in education, I assume as a parent, being part of the Board of Education, things like that. And that in a lot of respects has kind of shaped what Hypersign does, from what I can tell.
Yeah, our involvement in education, when I resigned from my company in Arkansas to come back home, you know, where my family grew up, I actually got involved accidentally inside the education market. It wasn't really so much about my parenting. Mm-hmm. It's that there was a local high school that was going through a large capital funding project of building a new school. See, when I was growing up, they didn't hardly build new schools. Mm-hmm. Now it seems like they're built all over the place. So they were at a 300-acre campus for this high school, almost 4,000 kids. And it was one of my schools I competed with playing baseball and stuff growing up. You know, actually my wife at the time, my first wife actually went to school there. So I just called up superintendent on the phone And I began to work for an integrator here locally for the first couple of years I was here. And I called him up on the phone and I said, listen, I'd like to design your network. I was a network engineer and, you know, electrical engineer and stuff like that. So I'd like to design your network and all your systems. And he says, okay. So I went over there and it was about over a $2 million job. It's my first job. It's over $2 million. And I became the chief engineer over that project. And that really got me because I was doing that project. It's called Dorman High School because I was doing that project and it was very, very large media because it was such a big school. It was such a big project. And I just happened to talk to the right person at the right time. I became very well educated in how to be able to get technology in the front end of a building construction project by using capital funding dollars. Hmm. So I began to work with the architects. I became a certified instructor for AIA. I began to work. That was my focus. My integration business was all around capital funded projects because I knew that organizations and schools are not an exception will spend more money on that than they would if it was from operating dollars, you know, because they're able to amortize that over a longer time period, you know, if this bond money or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. So I was involved in more than $2.5 billion in new construction over that 10-year period that I owned my integration business. Hmm. And that's where the digital industry or digital signage industry started to really start to evolve is near the tail end of that to where I started seeing flat panel displays. That's what really made a difference because before that, before flat panel displays, it was just like character generators and stuff like that that was going to CRTs or regular. And then we had the digital comb filtering displays. Then we had VGA on the back end of it. So that was all an evolution. But once the flat panels came around, that's when digital signage actually became something that and still, even right now, people are not recognizing that name. We go to the healthcare shows and they think digital signage is actually signing your name and digitizing it. You know what I mean? No, that has nothing to do with that.
Yeah, it's getting better, but I know what you mean. It's there's still a little confusion out there.
Sure.
So with HyperSign as it now sits, what all do you do? I understand it's a CMS. A lot of your focus is on education and healthcare. So what's kind of the product range that you have and what's unique about what you do versus the endless parade of other CMS solutions that are out there?
Well, like the two differentiators I talked to you about earlier about the PowerPoint, automatic PowerPoint conversion of our software and also the alert functionality that was built into it, some differentiators. We began to evolution the system to, even though we marketed ourselves as being a very deep solution for education and healthcare. And I did that from a strategic standpoint, meaning that I knew as a small business owner in South Carolina, I'm not in Seattle, I'm not in Silicon Valley, I'm not in all of the hotbeds of technology development. Mm-hmm. I'm in Greenville, South Carolina, which is, from a technology perspective, it's known from Cenex or BMW or, you know, so I had to do something to be able to have this stand out. And having a couple little cool features that made the software really work well is wasn't enough. It wasn't going to elevate us quick enough to be able to do that. So, but what was going to help us is by focusing on vertical markets, because if we could actually pair ourselves with a large manufacturer of complementary means, meaning that we didn't step on their toes and they didn't step on ours. We made their product better. And because these companies are large, they have to have vertical market teams. Therefore, if we are targeting a vertical market, we could align ourselves very well with their vertical market teams and go to market with them. Mm-hmm. So from the very beginning, we were not generalist. We didn't actually advertise like a lot of digital signage companies out there. We do everything and change your tires. You know, we do everything, you know. And we didn't do ourselves. We said, listen, we are the digital signage provider for education and healthcare. These are our markets.
Yeah.
And then when I stepped into Samsung, you know, they had not even come out with the SSP side.
Yeah.
When I stepped into Samsung and I stood in front of them and I said, I want to be your one and only, I want to be the first one off of Samsung salesperson's list to say for a solution for education and healthcare. I don't care who you give corporate messaging to. I don't care who you give, you know, the other vertical markets to. I want education and healthcare. And in return for that, I would not market another display solution other than Samsung. Mm-hmm. And it worked. And then Google approached me early last year. We had been selling Chromeboxes. They approached me and they said, listen, we want you to speak at Digital Signage Expo as a content matter expert on education and healthcare. And I did the same thing. And then Dell called. And Dell says, we want you to be able to do this. We want to sell your stuff too on our global. So we signed a global sales contract with Dell. And then CDW called and said, listen, we're really looking for a good solution for education and healthcare. Would you like to be that? And I'm like, yeah, wait, let's do it. Let's set it up. You know?
Does Does it surprise you? I mean, down the highway from you, Vizix is pretty active in the education market. Four Winds is pretty active in the education market. But does it surprise you that nobody has really gone, you know, all in on education or healthcare the way you guys did?
I think it was a strategy that we decided to do at that particular time, whether right or wrong. You know you're wrong when it doesn't work. You know, that's how you know you're wrong. After the fact, you know, it's all, you know, retrospective. But what we're seeing now is that we do have a feature set that really services that vertical industry very well. And compared to those two companies, we're a smaller company. Mm-hmm. We're not as big as those two. We didn't require that much funding that both the companies had. You know, so we actually are able to elevate ourselves to a point because of our relationships and because of what we do. We're very agile when it comes to development. I mean, I can sit around my war room table with my dev team and saying, you know, I want this and I want it next sprint. Mm-hmm. And it's done. You know, we're so agile when it comes to that, which normally it takes a lot more involvement with the organization to be able to have that type of agility.
And how, you know, what's the size of your company right now and the size of the, you know, your deployed estate, the number of?
We're about 20 in this office, but I have a partner that is actually a large telecommunications carrier out of Rock Hill that has about 2,400 employees. Mm-hmm. So they're my partner, but we have about 20 working just on development and sales. So all of the back office stuff is done by my partner company. So if we had to employ everything directly, we're probably talking about 30 employees. But mm-hmm. we're just doing dev and sales, biz dev and dev out of this out of our main office, and then they take care of all the legal and the accounting and all the aspects of that aspect of it. So 20, and then we're running around 3,000 customers, and that's globally because we have customers that are in Dubai and Asia. And around Africa, actually got some stuff around Africa going on right now. But with the lion's share of that being in the vertical markets that we targeted, but now other markets are starting to grow.
Okay. So when you talk about 3,000 customers, you're talking about 3,000 accounts or 3,000 software licenses?
No, 3,000 accounts.
Okay. So
now, a lot of them may be pretty low volume. We've got some large customers that may have several hundred.
Sure.
You know, in there, but the majority of our customers will end up being between the 5 and 15, you know, license point. And then we also have a desktop, Hypersign desktop alert license, which mm-hmm. is actually clearly part of that. We have some customers just want desktop alert, mm-hmm. you know, so, but see, yeah, it's about 3,000, and we're 100% cloud now. We actually dumped the enterprise side of that about 2014 to do 100% cloud, like a lot of people did. But right now we're seeing a trend. Matter of fact, we had a meeting this morning in our staff meeting to modify our website because I actually had a meeting yesterday with a very large QSR chain, and little did we know that they had already been trying our software out.
Yeah.
They were just doing a trial, free trial. And they said, listen, we've got 4,000 locations that we want to talk to you about. H&R Block, we want to talk to you about our 1,200 locations we have across the U.S. We're seeing more areas outside of our core that we marketed to mm-hmm. because they like our interface. They mm-hmm. like the way our software looks. They like our price points because we're very transparent on our pricing. We can put it right there on a webpage. You know, we have multiple ways to purchase. You know, we can purchase through the channel, or we can purchase direct if it makes sense to be able to do it that way. So it just makes it easy. We try to remove, this is what I tell my staff all the time. We need to remove any reason for someone not to buy our software.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I found interesting is the integration that you've had on campuses and in healthcare institutions. And one that particularly struck me was what you've done with something called Kid Gopher. Can you give me sort of a quick rundown on what that's all about?
Yeah, we were actually approached by a school district several years ago about the vulnerability of young children because the divorce rate was on a rapid incline. I don't think it's rising as rapidly in Canada as it is in the U.S., but it's still there. But it was a rapid incline. And the schools were having an increasingly more difficult time in controlling the dismissal process of these small children. And one for instance of this was in Dallas, Texas, which is one of our newer, we got a contract with Dallas ISD back in January, and we're real fortunate about this. But in Dallas ISD several years ago, there was a typical pickup of a six-year-old little boy, and his uncle was asked to pick up the child because the mother and father actually had some business things that had taken them away, and they'd asked the uncle, say, go and pick it up. And he said, well, I might have to. He had to be somewhere right after picking up the child. So he went by, picked up the kid, got several miles down the street, and realized not only did he pick up his nephew, but his nephew decided to bring his best friend. Mm. And when you have a child abduction situation, law enforcement are instructed to be able to do a 2-mile radius of the abduction location around the space, lock it down. and they were at a 3 mile. And this gentleman decided, okay, I've got this meeting I've got to be to. Hey, here's a playground park. I'm going to drop this little boy off at this playground park, and I'm going to call the school and let him know where he is.
God.
And the little boy was missing until the next morning.
Oh, man.
So that's just an example. If you talk to any principal, and we've got some testimonials on our KidGopher site, they'll tell you the moment that you end up losing a child is the moment that your career is over.
Mm-hmm.
And that afternoon pickup process at elementary school is the most hectic time of the day because you have impatient parents. You have children that are excited. They really don't see the safety or lack of. They really don't see that issue. They think everybody's going to be innocent and you're good to go. So we saw an opportunity to be able to say, let's manage this process for them. Let's actually create a system that uses digital signage inside the staging areas or classrooms. Let's use technology, including the mobile technology and apps, to be able to verify that the person who was going around to pick up this child is actually valid. They're actually the one supposed to be picking them up. Even as difficult as having a very elegant scheduling system to say, dad can pick them up on Monday, mom on Tuesday and Wednesday, dad again on Thursday, and then the primary parent could actually allow maybe other people inside the family or neighborhood to be able to pick them up on certain days, however they want to be able to do it. And the result was we actually got calls from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and by the Amber Alert Coalition, in which the Amber Alert Coalition says, can we work with you on the ability to issue an Amber Alert directly from your software? I'm like, yeah. I mean, nobody else is doing that. So what we do is actually we do an endangered child alert, which actually is sent to the state law offices for the particular state this software or the school is located in. And then they elevate it to an Amber Alert and send it out to media. And so we have quickened the process from 2 hours from abduction to be able to go in from a time of abduction to the DOT signs to a matter of about 15 minutes. So that's the power of KidGopher. I'm actually flying out to Austin, Texas tomorrow. I'm actually the speaker at a conference in Austin, Texas in front of the superintendents of 100 of the largest school districts in the country. And I'm speaking to them about child abduction and preventing a child abduction.
And yeah, and you might bring some business cards with you.
I think I might do that. Yeah, I was actually considering that.
So we're running out of time, but I did want to ask you, and I ask this of a lot of people, where do you see your company and the industry in general going over the next couple of years?
I see us going through our third evolution. I think our first evolution when the digital industry started was barbecue sandwiches are for lunch today. We just put the graphic up on the screen. It became a basic static some type of messaging about what's going on for lunch, really around food service displays.
Mm-hmm.
Then we went to this evolution several years ago to where now data is becoming more prevalent. Now do we have to have more relevant data, multi-zone content that's relevant to the people that's going to end up being there in the form of, I want a back office digital sign to show my key performance indicators of my team and how they're performing.
Mm-hmm.
I want to be able to have live television integrated. I want to be able to have multiple facets all over the place of data that's coming to this sign. That was our second evolution. Our third evolution is happening right now. And the third evolution is actually going to where the content is even more granular to the individual, meaning that I can walk in front of a hypersign with my Bluetooth enabled phone in my back pocket and it knows who I am. And I'm not talking about the facial recognition stuff. I'm talking about, like, this is stuff that's going to be common. It's going to be your whole Tom Cruise, you know, Minority Report thing from years ago, except instead of actually that iris recognition, it's using that BLE to be able to do it. So bridging of the BLE and bridging of the digital signage, and that will end up ushering in the introduction of IoT into the commercial space, which is really exciting because I have, you know, with the Samsung connection and with another connection I have with ownership, I have a meeting next week in Manhattan with Samsung about IoT with Hypersign and Samsung integration.
Mm-hmm.
And that's incredibly exciting. It really is.
Is that possible because of the way BLE is evolving and kind of getting away from a dependence on an app and it'll just be more like Google Eddystone where it's just on the device layer of the phone?
I think it's going to do that because there's a way for BLE used for triangulation, of course. It's not really communicating unless you're doing some of the Aruba tied in with the wireless, some of the more advanced analytics. I think BLE has a simple function of triangulation of your location and actually triggering content based off that location. And I think that with the application itself and the combination of being able to tie back over the web or over the particular cloud through the connection to the digital signage provider to trigger content automatically based off that physical position of that individual. So I think BLE is going to take a really key part of that, more so than like RFID did. You know, you really didn't have any integration with RFID and digital signage for the most part. I think more than like a biometric, because it involves touch and more of an intimate touch, which they really don't want that. And more like the iris, I think the BLE is gonna end up really being a really game changer when it comes to digital signage. And I'm not sure I answered your question effectively, Dave, but
I think you did. BLE, and I think what it's really saying is this is all evolving and it's not going to stop evolving anytime soon.
Yeah, and I think BLE is just a touch on it. I think when you get to IoT, to where you're putting some type of sensor or trigger mechanism on pretty much everything. I mean, right now in my home, my mother's blind. And so it has motivated me to do some things within my home. And I walk into my home and my Amazon Echo controls all of my lighting through my Hue lighting system. Mm-hmm. It controls my Nest thermostat. It controls my my electronic lock on all my deadbolts in my door. You know, it has sensors to tell me if I've got flooding in my basement, all this kind of stuff. Controls my television navigation, because I built it traditionally to be able to help my mother. But really, it's just a cool thing to show. Hey, Alexa, turn on the fireplace. You know, yeah. The fireplace lights up. You know, you have people over, you know. But I think carrying that into the commercial space and the IoT aspect of it is not only was John Chambers right on the money when he talked about how large of a market this is going to end up being. You know, I think it's going to even be more than that because of some of the players that are now coming into the B2B space that has used that IoT technology inside the B2C space. And then digital signage is going to be the window to that content. Hmm. You know, it's going to be the window of that content. And that's where we want to be, right in the middle of it. Where do we want to be as a company? I want to be, when I say large, I don't mean from an employee standpoint. I want to be scalable, but I want to be considered to be the leaders inside this industry. And it doesn't mean that I have more employees, because I learned my lesson a long time ago that the fact that you have more employees does not mean that you're a bigger company.
Yeah, yeah.
I was a young man when I learned that lesson. But I want to be considered as being the leaders. When people hear the name Hypersign, it actually resonates quality. It resonates reliability. It resonates innovation. Hmm. You know, our company values of being a Southern company, being a Southern technology company, is iced tea, innovation, compassion, excellence, and transparency.
All right. That's a good way to close it. Neil Willis, thank you very much for your time today.
Very good. Thank you, Dave.
That's it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed listening and that you learned something. If you want to stay on top of what's happening and actually matters in digital signage, join thousands of readers who visit 16.9, that's 16-9.net every day, and subscribe to this podcast as I stick my shiny new Tascam recorder in the faces of more industry people in the coming weeks. Thanks again for listening. 16.9, the blog, and now the podcast are both properties of Vertical Media Consulting Group, the massive media empire I run out of a spare bedroom in my house near Toronto. I'm Dave Haynes.